Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to the Realignments, intermittent but very meaty Q&A AMA portions that we give to our Supercast subscribers. If you are not subscribed to our Supercast already, you will not be able to get the full access to this conversation. But if you go to your show notes and click the subscribe link or go to realignment.supercast.com, you get full access to all of our conversation, the questions, and even have the ability to submit your own at the Realignment Supercast site. Once again, realignment.supercast.com. We appreciate all the support and the fact that we can give out great exclusive content like this. Let's get into the first question. A lot of really great ones today. Really pumped about this one. Personal backgrounds influence on views. Feel free, of course, to skip this if you want to be too, if you don't want to be too open. But how do you think each of your backgrounds influence / inform your political views? This is an identity politics question, which might piss off a lot of listeners, but to a point, I think it helps give context. This, of course, doesn't have to be limited to identity, class, race, gender, religious, or lack thereof, but could be where you grew up in the country and your educational experience. What do you think, Sagar?
Yeah, I mean, I actually feel like I'm really open. I don't know about you, Marshall. I think I'm pretty open about what my background is, like how exactly it influenced me. I've said before, like it had like a weird childhood, especially given 9/11, not exactly fond of the place that I come from, College Station, Texas. That being said, I don't let it define my entire life. And I also let whatever my experience is in Washington, D.C. and working in quote unquote professional politics kind of coincide with that. And that's just really form my view. What do you think? I mean, I feel like we're pretty open about it, honestly.
No, for sure. And I appreciate the way that the questioner phrased this question, because there's a very cringy boomer version of identity politics doesn't matter. And we're all just Americans. So talking about that stuff is weird. Like, no, like it matters. Background matters. Experiences matter. We're not just looking at the world and looking at the news and just saying, this is what's happening and this is why it's happening. We're putting it through the lens of our own experiences. My quick version of this is, look, you guys know most of these details. We're very open about this. I'm from an upper middle class background. I'm from Oregon. I'm Black, but I'm adopted and I'm Jewish. My parents work in the climate change space. So obviously all those issues specifically together are going to make me look at the world through a really specific lens. I'd say the thing that's definitely done the most for me is it's helped me. I think this is why I'm a more of a decent interviewer. I just understand different perspectives really well. Someone on the Reddit was talking about how Marshall does a good job of just articulating what an actual leftist thinks about things, even if I'm not a leftist. And when I'm going through my own life, I'm looking at the things through the lens of being Black, but also being Jewish and also being from a Ukrainian adopted background. I'm going to have to balance different bits of identity. This is definitely probably the point where I'm most sympathetic to left-leaning social justice people when it comes to identity really mattering, because it's like that for me. I think I'd be much different if I were my parents' biological child rather than here. You look a little skeptical though. What's up?
No, I'm not skeptical. I was saying, yeah, I mean, I think I'm probably the same. I mean, you know, I'm like American, like born here, but my parents aren't from here. So, and I spent a lot of time abroad. In fact, most of my formative experiences were not in the United States. It was like very intermittent. I'd be like here during the school year, in the summer I'd be in some other country. I think I visited like 25 countries before I was even 18 years old. So I guess for me, I have a bit more of a tourist objective eye of the US. I'm able to just like pull myself. I can look at America the way I can look at like Yemen. I can just look at like fundamentals, different tribes or whatever, and be like, yeah, this side, one thinks this one. And I don't feel like a deep connection to it because I don't have one, to be honest. Like whatever my connection is just me. And like, where I've lived. So yeah, I think it actually helps. Maybe why I'm a good analyst, honestly.
Yeah, the last thing I would add, and this tends to come up from folks who don't like either of us, career-wise, the fact that we spent 2015 through 2017 in think tank world, incredibly useful. This is probably the area where I tend to disagree most with folks in independent media, especially creator people. Independent media, YouTube, podcasting really selects for outsiders, folks who didn't come up in the middle of things, didn't get the right graduate degrees. And it's an example of how the internet actually is very cool. It selects not for, do you impress your boss or do you get your PhD dissertation? It's, can you be entertaining? Can people resonate with you? Are you charismatic? Like those are really strong advantages. And honestly, like those are the things that I really struggle with because they just are not what I was taught. coming up in DC. I was taught, where are your credentials, Sagar? You and I disagree on Ukraine, but you know, how good was your graduate program? Like that's the natural way that discourse really comes down. Like, where's the PhD? But when you go through that system, you do kind of understand how power actually works. And this is where just the biggest gap with independent media folks come from. Look, I've sat next to Paul Wolfowitz at a holiday Christmas party. Paul Wolfowitz is one of the originators of the invasion of the Iraq war. Scooter Libby is down the hall. He was Dick Cheney's chief of staff for me when I'm in the Hudson office a few years ago. When you actually interact with folks who really disagree with, you start to understand like, oh, wow, people just believe what they believe. I say that's the number one thing. And this may institute a bias within me. This probably makes me a little more skeptical of like quote unquote corruption than I maybe should be from a pure like media perspective. But I just really have taken away this idea, and my background has given me this, that actually like a lot of the time at the levels we're really talking about, people are kind of operating in good faith. Like Paul Wolfowitz like actually thought that he was doing the right thing when he invaded Iraq. There wasn't anyone from Halliburton offering him a check under the table. Scooter Libby actually thought that he and Dick Cheney had a good, strong grasp of the U.S.'s interest in the Middle East. You could disagree with them. I disagree with them. But that's a completely different point than how does this actually work and originate?
Yeah, I agree. And I've actually said it. I said it would be easier if it was money. I wish it was just money. And I, like,
because you pass a law, you pass a law.
Yeah, I really actually wish it was money, because if it was, it'd be a lot easier in order to do something about. Now, I'm not going to say that money doesn't have anything to do with it. And I also, okay, here's where I would say like the fairest critique is: both of those guys are doing pretty well in life. And the fact that they didn't quote unquote suffer market-based consequences for being so wrong, I think is an indictment of a system, but I'm not going to call it corrupt. Does that make sense? So like when I use the word corrupt, I actually use it very, very carefully. At least I think so. On exact systems like I'm talking about, things that are underlying and actual scams. This, I just call a failed system. And that's actually very different than being corrupt. Once again, it's easier for it to be corrupt. Corruption is more of a one-way transaction. Systemic issues are actually way harder and more multifaceted in order to deal with. I hope that's making sense to people.
No, that makes a lot of sense. There's a question about think tanks where that's going to come a little later in the episode. I want folks to just remember what you just said, because that's a great way of articulating how that system actually works. Next question, really like this one: Political Coalition for American Dynamism. Following up on your recent podcast with Catherine Boyle and Mark Andreessen, I've been considering what a political coalition would look like that focused on, to use Catherine's thesis, American dynamism. In short, a political philosophy that focuses on building in service of national greatness, more housing, infrastructure, clean energy, schools, rockets, defense technology, and institutions that ambitiously aim to solve hard problems. In particular, building more supply in, quote, big three areas that Mark noted as having escaped the deflationary effect of technology: housing, education, and healthcare. There seems to be a lot of interest in these broad ideas in certain wonky circles. For example, Ezra Klein's supply-side progressivism / liberalism that builds, Matt Iglesias's 1 Billion Americans, progress studies from Tyler Cowen and Patrick Collison, and the new Institute for Progress think tank. Many more focused on creating abundance as an antidote to rising cost. What are your thoughts on the potential to create such a coalition? One interesting parallel is to the cross-party reform movement that arose in the late 19th century as an antidote to systemic corruption. Could you see elements of the right and left come together on policy ideas as an antidote to stagnation and sclerosis, like deregulating zoning or the building of green energy projects? What other areas are ripe for this kind of coalition? That's a very learned question. This person is either
this person
live
is way too online.
You live in San Francisco or Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
This is a very, this is it, because the
or
Institute
you're extremely
for Progress,
online. Yeah.
weird mix of the three. Sagar, what's your immediate response?
I don't want to sound like a dick to said person, but I don't believe that a political coalition like that exists in the United States right now. And I wish it did. I just did a live show with you, Marshall, in Atlanta, and a bunch of people cheered about nuclear power to me. But I'm not naive enough to think that that's a real political constituency that's capable of activating in the American electorate. And here's the truth. The American electorate writ large, at large, the writ large thing was a joke for those who were at the Atlanta show. The American electorate at large, as a mass populace, is not activated by a quote unquote positive agenda. They're mad. They're really pissed off. The vast majority of the evidence that we have over the last 20 years is that people are voting against something. Now, I have a lot of friends who are saying that's because nobody's ever given them anything to vote for. And that's honestly bullshit. Joe Biden literally passed the child tax credit, which had the largest drop in child poverty in modern American history. Here's the thing. Nobody cared. Whenever it went away, there was no organic political constituency clamoring for it to come back. To the limited evidence that we have, Republicans were pissed that people were getting money, and Democrats were pissed that it went away, but they gave no reward to the people who gave it to them. Now, I'm not saying this as a judgment against either side. I'm just describing an actual political dynamic. You are better off in modern American politics running against something and not, quote unquote, for something. I don't wish it worked that way. I considered it myself to be exactly one of these people who would love to see an American dynamist agenda, nuclear power and all that. But that's why I don't work in politics, like capital P pop. That's why I don't run for office. That's why I'm like building like a quote unquote small community online with the hope that 20, 30 years from now, if the political dynamics change, that we can glom onto whatever the actual capital P political movement is and say, hey, I've had all these people, I've been doing all this work, blah, 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 blah. Let's get this done when the moment is right. But now it's not that moment, even though we desperately need it. So there you go.
Yeah, I'll kind of reframe what you're saying because I actually agree with you on this. You and I, when we're doing political analysis, we're trying to give people hope. Like, we're just always going back to this age of acrimony idea. Like, once again, cannot emphasize how much folks should read this book. Actually, I had a couple of folks buy it on the bookshop recently, so I'm glad that our shout outs really help. That it's the 1890s. This is not Teddy Roosevelt is in office in 1905, and America is aggressively making moves to confront the set of issues that are here. It's the 1890s in the sense that you have these nascent ideas. I do think building really matters. And the reason why the building and the American dynamism idea seems to be onto something at a level deeper than Andrew Yang's Forward or Never Trumpism or like we're going to save American dynamism or we're going to save American democracy is that American dynamism as a construct, this thesis of building and fixing things, it actually has the basis for what a new consensus politics could look like at its best. So when I'm referring to consensus politics, I'm talking about the 1950s. This isn't ahistorical 1950s, everyone had their white picket fence and the, man in the gray flannel suit, Don Draper is on his way to becoming a madman, all those different bits. No, like this is the fact that the 1950s were very difficult. There's a lot of controversy in American society. But there was just this underlying consensus around a couple of big questions: the Cold War, infrastructure projects, investing in science and technology in response to the threat of Sputnik and the Soviet Union. You know, there wasn't that much difference between Richard Nixon and JFK in a bunch of respects. Obviously, if you are a leftist, that's a problem. If you are a Goldwater conservative, that's a problem. But if you're talking about the center not meaning like center trademark, I'm launching a think tank that kind of grifts off of rich people and former Republicans, but center in the sense that there is an actual sphere of the American populace that wants to actually get something. So if you have a proper censor and a proper consensus, it's not that there aren't going to be massive debates. The Red Scare happened during the consensus 1950s. You had the Hollywood blacklist. Harry Truman literally couldn't run for re-election because the Korean War was going so badly, all those different bits. But there was just this center of agreement about a set of situations that were bad and have to actually be addressed. And American dynamism just has that. The lack of building, the issues of energy. Sagar, you've had some really great monologues lately on energy and how California's grid doesn't work. Texas also has a grid that doesn't work. So these two different poles of the country. I
always say that. Can I just say that? Please. Everybody always criticizes me because they're like, you're only focused on California. By the way, first of all, Breaking Points wasn't around whenever the Texas grid failed. Rising was. And if you go back and you watch what I said, I clearly identified it as corruption and lack of infrastructure spending. And I've consistently skewered the Texas government for doing the exact same thing. In fact, the Texas government, part of their issue is they never failed to weatherize their natural gas equipment. And they also continue to get a shit ton of their energy from coal, which I think is bad, given that we have several different alternatives. So anyway, yeah, that's a particular bugaboo of mine. Whenever people say that I'm like needlessly picking on California, the point that I'm making is that two of the largest states in the nation are not supplying consistent and cheap power. And this was my pushback to Crystal. which is, she was like, yeah, but it didn't fail. I'm like, listen, I have to keep my house fucking 78 in the middle of 100 degree, in the middle of 105 degree weather. Like, that's the failure. That's the point of abundance, is that we shouldn't have to do that. And here's the thing. It's not 1890. We don't have to. We do have abundant power sources and other things that we can invest in as a country. We are just choosing not to that. Right now, I'm watching Germany shut down their literal factories because they refuse to, they literally shut down their factories because they don't have enough natural gas and because the prices of power are so high, inducing a trade deficit and a literal recession on the continent of Europe. Like, these things have material consequences. And that's actually why I believe so strongly in abundance, Marshall. But I just fall back on, there is no evidence that people want it. Like, there is, and even if it's a solution to your problem, you could, people do this all the time. They're like, why won't these idiots just wake up? Look, you cannot force people to care about something. That's just not how politics works. Politics works by trying to get your interests to align and trying to get and meet the moment and then try eventually, when the quote unquote time is right, in order to have these syntheses happen. But, you know, to be fair, the 1950s came at the cost of immense political turmoil and debates of the 1930s and the 1940s. 1930s in particular, where we had vehement disagreements about the scope of government, the New Deal level. And then, you know, 1940s, obviously, debates around the war and then World War II mobilization. I also think a lot of people paper over the immense disagreements that we had in this country from 1946 until 1952, when Eisenhower was president. We had actual railway strikes where the president had to draft rail workers. We had massive inflation. We had an employment crisis. We had to like deal with the GI Bill and all these crazy wonky labor things. We had to deal with the Marshall Plan, the Soviet blockade of Germany or of Berlin, like the Berlin. Like, we had an insane period in order to arrive at that. So I always just think people really paper over the amount of problems you kind of have to solve to have a golden age like that. And then even when you do have a golden age, it all blows up, you know, 10 years later.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. And this is why, to go back to the first question we answered, a bias that you and I may have because of the fact that we're very young, 30 somethings, we can wait for those 10 years. Do you ever think about this? Do you ever think I think this plays a role in whether someone is a doomer or not. If you were an ambitious, this is something I'll think about. If you're an ambitious person who, let's say, wanted to solve climate change or address energy issues, and guess what? It's the 2000s and you're our age. That sucks.
Yeah.
If you were a smart, ambitious Democrat who was going to come into office, let's say, as like an assistant secretary of state in Al Gore's presidency, if he'd won, but then George W. Bush wins for 8 years, then you're done. Man, like, think about Bridge Colby. Bridge Colby is a huge friend of the show. We love having Bridge Colby on, talk about defense policy. Bridge Colby only got to go into government at the senior level he did because Trump was the president. If Hillary had won in 2016, all of his defense policy work, all of his national defense strategy would have meant nothing. And he would have been, assuming Hillary gets reelected in 2020, which he probably would have been, maybe 2024, he's like 49, 50 years old. And there's a younger version of Rich Colby taking advantage of him. So when Sagar and I are talking about how it's like the 1890s and that we just have to not wait for 10 years, but there's all this interesting intellectual and organic work happening over the 10 years in the future that's going to really build something in the 2030s, a bit of that could be the fact that you and I, no matter what, are going to be in the room for those conversations, or at the minimum, we'll be talking about them with a degree of influence given our media platform. So I think about that when I think of us telling people, look, the next 10 years are going to be tough, because like structurally, that means that we still get to be a part of that, versus if you're in your 50s, if there's 10 years, you're out. And that's just how the system does
work. Life is about timing. Those people got to enjoy a childhood in the 90s, which wasn't shit. So, you know, it's all a trade-off.
That's a very eloquent way of putting it. So next question. This is a very, very smart question. I really like this one. Hear me through the Ukraine war part, because it gets at something deeper than the typical one. Ukraine war question. After the success of Ukraine's counteroffensive, would you agree that Russia faces a decision similar to the troop surge during the Iraq war? bonus question, is there any useful comparison to the Tet Offensive in Vietnam? This is such a good question because it shows
no to
that
the second, but anyway,
yeah. So yeah, no to the second, because the key thing about the Tet Offensive and in terms of its like immediate aftermath is it literally was such a political victory that the death deal of the war happened and the Vietnamization happens like within 6 months. And I just don't say, obviously maybe there could be something like maybe Putin is deposed in like 6 months. And then let's just say if Putin were to be deposed months, we would say this was the equivalent, but actually no, but the Tet Offensive was defeated militarily. So I guess that's why
it doesn't make any sense, which is that the Russians, I mean, look, honestly, it's probably most analogous in my head to like one of those early offensives in the First World War, like one of those quote unquote breakthroughs on the First World War where, and again, this is why it's complicated because actually some of those breakthroughs did justify big political victories at the time, but on a long enough time scale, basically ended up meaning nothing. Now, in terms of the overall strategic importance of that counteroffensive, it's reclaimed 5% of territory that's been seized. Marshall, while you and I are talking, this literally just broke across the wire, but Moscow has just called for their quote unquote annexation votes. So it's not like politically that they're backing down or that it's changed their calculus. If anything, it's moving them forward. I actually think the questioner's relation to this, to the surge, is the perfect example, which is Russia tried to do to Ukraine what we did in Iraq. They put in a subpar force. It turns out the Ukrainian, I mean, it's not one-to-one because the Ukrainian military forces aren't an insurgency, but the Ukrainian military forces ended up punching much more above their weight. Their military commanders ended up being inept, tremendous loss of life. You're beginning to see a stagnation and a quagmire at home, a growing acknowledgement of that in the Russian political press. So what happens? Well, now it's decision time. You force your hand, you have to either call for conscription. There are some, by the way, some reports out there that they could be moving towards some sort of conscription, some sort of higher level of mobilization, societal, like more all in. I mean, we should not underestimate their capacity in order to put more propaganda forward. It wouldn't surprise me to have this annexation vote be one of the preludes exactly to that, Marshall. Because think about it from their way, their like twisted way. If we fake annex these areas into Russia, then any Ukrainian fighting on this territory is now attacking sovereign Russian territory, which justifies a war of defense. Now, obviously, it's bullshit, but I'm saying rhetorically, that's how it would work. And it would be a smart way for Putin to move it in that direction. So I think the surge thing is exactly right.
Very good answer, because the key thing is mobilization. The Russians have not mobilized their society. They have not had a draft. The reason why you're seeing stories about the Wagner group going through prisons is the Russians are desperate, frankly, up until the offensive, to do whatever they could to keep this constrained to a special military operation about Eastern Ukraine. If you were to call up a draft, that would basically mean the policy failed. A draft, because you got to think of it, you're like, wait, why wouldn't the Russians just go all out? Why would they hold back? Because escalating past their current point now would basically be an admission of defeat in terms of the overall statement.
Well, it was a lie. It's kind of like Iraq, which is that the lie was like, oh, yeah, it'll be a cakewalk, like all that. And Americans were like, okay, whatever. That's kind of how Russians feel. They're like, yeah, fuck the West, but you know, I don't really want to do a whole lot about it.
Yeah. And the thing that I just want to explain at a history level, because we've talked a lot about the start of the Iraq War. We don't really talk about the surge, because I'm in the awkward position where was against the start of the Iraq War, but was and am very pro-surge. So here's where the metaphor works for folks who don't know the issue that well, though the questioner obviously does. So if it's 2006, Iraq has literally gone into a civil war. A major, was it a Shia shrine or was it a Sunni shrine that was blown up? A Sunni insurgents / Al-Qaeda / terrorists blew up a deeply important Shia mosque and effectively started a civil war in the country. You had Iraqi government, which is Shia dominated, death squads literally going through hospitals and executing people. Very, very, very bad. The country is turning into a total disaster, which places the U.S. politically an incredibly difficult position, because obviously at that time it's like, wow, this war is a quagmire, there were no weapons of mass destruction, we not only aren't preventing the rise of terrorism by invading. We've actually created a hotbed for terrorism. We need to pull out. But if the country's in the middle of a civil war that we've caused, we are in the middle of the definition of a you break it, you buy it decision. So the decision we make, and this is, I think, a example of George W. Bush being a successful president. Once again, it's his fault for getting us there. So let's not overpraise here. But he makes a decision that, no, like, we are going to do what we can to reduce the civil war, which is effectively what we go into. Obviously, at a political level, the surge is interesting because there are two levels to it. So level one was, we're going to reduce violence. So the point of the surge was, we're going to increase the number of troops in Iraq, which, per Sagar, you're in my discussion episode a few weeks ago, was the opposite of what was supposed to happen. We're supposed to take Iraq easily with a smaller, lighter military. We vastly pour troops into the country. And then what we also do at the same time is we also say to ourselves, if we place U.S. troops in the middle of the population, in the cities, will reduce violence, will help things calm down. And then that will force the Iraqis to come to a political settlement, which will lead to peace in the country. We get number one correct. It's the US military. Big difference between us and Russia is our military is actually competent. We reduce violence. The country gets more peaceful. It's 2009. However, what we do not succeed in doing, and this is what leads to the rise of ISIS, is this peace does not resolve the political situation in the country, which is that the Shia had the majority. They were repressed by Saddam. The Sunnis were in the minority. They don't have power anymore, and they're at each other's throats. And because this wasn't resolved, eventually you have Sunni-led, ISIS rise in the western part of the country, and then we're then stuck there after leaving 2011 for another 6 to 7 years. So it's just like a really fascinating example of how complicated the story of the Iraq war is. Now, I want to get to the rest of our gated questions. We went a little longer, but it's been a few weeks since we've done a Q&A episode, so I wanted to give people the maximum preview. If you are getting this notification, it's because you are going to stop hearing this episode any longer. So if you'd like to hear the rest, go to realignment.supercast.com. Once again, realignment.supercast.com, or go listen in your show notes.